This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 9th of November 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, we'll be analysing the latest on Burma's unfolding election. The result looks convincing, a possible landslide for Aung San Suu Kyi, but is the country's political model ready for the rigours of a fully functioning democracy? My guests, Isabel Hilton and Quentin Peel, will be looking at this and more, including, have the BRICS had its day? The grouping of Brazil, Russia, India and China as economically comparable nations back at the start of the century now looks like an investment providing less and less returns. We'll also ask whether the UK needs a foreign policy rethink after a damning report on its lack of authority on the world stage. And we'll look at the future of Chinese and Taiwanese relations too. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue, and Quentin Peel, associate fellow at Chatham House and a contributor for the Financial Times. Isabel and Quentin, welcome to you both. Counting is well underway in Burma, or Myanmar, after the country's first real elections in a generation. Dissident-turned-opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi's National League of Democracy Party, the NLD, may be heading for a landslide victory against the ruling Union Solidarity and Development Party, the USDP. But what kind of victory is it when your party leader is barred from becoming president by the country's constitution? Burma's military, which drafted the constitution, included a handy clause banning anyone married to a foreign national from leading the country, and that includes Aung San Suu Kyi. Isabel Hilton, that's not the only thing within the constitution which is going to be a problem for the opposition if indeed they do win by a landslide. 25% of the seats within Burma's parliament are reserved for the military anyway, so she needs to win two-thirds of the seats just to get a simple majority.
Yes, and she certainly needs to win rather more than that would have any hope of changing the constitution, which would be, I guess, slightly further down the line. But I think the main thing she's going to face, and I'm assuming that she is going to win a landslide. All the signs seem to be that she is, and she's even making some impressive gains in ethnic minority areas. But quite how to manage the relationship with the military at this point, it's still extremely sensitive. And if you look at other countries that have had to do this, Chile, for instance, had a constitution drawn up by Pinochet, which similarly reserved large numbers of seats for the military, and it in fact turned into a transition that was relatively calm because it wasn't pushed too hard or too fast by the opposition when they won. And my guess is that she will assume a position, as she puts it, above the president, but that she will be fairly judicious in terms of pushing the military to adjust the constitutional arrangements too soon.
Quentin Peel, if we look at how she's dealt with the past 5 years after she was released from house arrest after the last elections in 2010, it does suggest, as Isabel has suggested there, that she will be cautious, that she will try to work within the system as much as possible, because that is how she's got this far over the last 5 years.
Yes, I mean, she's demonstrated a quite extraordinary combination of patience and yet determination over these last... I mean, 25 years ago, she won a landslide in the country and it was effectively disallowed. And she spent most 20 years pretty well under house arrest. So it is extraordinary that she seems to be coming back again with a very similar sort of result. It's not... absolute landslide in popular vote. It looks like, you know, that you get 55-60% and you'll get 80% of the seats. Now, she's now got a very difficult negotiation still ahead of her, I think, with the military. And I think it could take really quite a long time. It could take many months. So nothing's going to move that quickly. And if there are tensions with some of the ethnic minorities, with some of the difficult breakaway and rebel factions in the country, that's still got to be resolved, as is, of course, the fundamental split, if you like, between the Buddhists and Muslims in the country.
It's something which Isabel, so far Aung San Suu Kyi has been very cautious about voicing any opinion on at all. I mean, even the word Rohingya doesn't pass her lips.
Disappointingly quiet on the subject, you might think. And again, it remains to be seen if she is assured of a very solid majority, whether she will then feel that she can speak. I mean, I can imagine that before the election, she's having to deal with some extreme Buddhist nationalist elements who would otherwise, I guess, be in her support. She's had a rather, you know, complicated route through a number of minefields to pick out. But I would think that if she doesn't at this point, if she doesn't, once the election is over, say and do something positive about the situation with the Rohingya, then I think that people will begin to judge her fairly harshly, at least on the outside.
Inside the country, Quentin, do you think it's going to help her that she is, despite being an opposition figure, despite having been under house arrest, in many ways, she is an establishment figure in Burma. Her father, Aung San, was one of the main military leaders that helped Burma get its independence a couple of generations ago. That surely helps the way that the military and the most senior monks and the establishment really view her, doesn't it?
Yes, I think so. I think that she has been a remarkable figure. And although I know she's been criticised now as being rather autocratic and actually saying, hey, even if I'm not president, I'm really going to run the country. The truth is that it's needed somebody like her. I mean, I hasten perhaps to compare her with somebody like Nelson Mandela, but you need a very big figure to make a transition like this. And up till now, on the whole, she's managed to achieve that. But this is a country which is right at this extraordinary Asian crossroads. You've got China, India, the whole of Southeast Asia all surrounding it. You've got an economy that's been in a desperate state, very dominated by China. But China's now been taking more of a back seat.
And that's one of the interesting things, isn't it, Isabel, about sort of Burma's sort of step back towards opening up and being more of a democracy and opening up its economy, was its fear that it was essentially not quite being ruled by Beijing, but it was...
Close. But yes,
quite close. And part of the deal with the West was, OK, fine, we'll come in, we'll help you liberalise your economy, so to speak, but we need to see some steps towards democracy.
You can spin it back a little further, which was that the sanctions that the West imposed drove Burma into the arms of China in ways that even the military began to feel extremely concerned about. And you might remember that the first one of the first actions by Ten Sein when he took power was to cancel or postpone, as he put it, a very, very large infrastructure project on the Irrawaddy, the Myitsone Dam. That remains suspended. And he has said, when asked what would happen in 2015, he essentially said if he was still in power, it would stay suspended. And that was a huge slap in the face to Beijing. And Beijing reacted pretty badly. And then there was a copper mine and so on. So there are still big projects. But these projects tended in the past to have been between Chinese military companies and Burmese military companies. Both are rather less popular and rather less assured of their place at the heart of the economy than they were. So I don't think that will change. Although again, Aung San Suu Kyi has been fairly emollient vis-a-vis one of those projects, which was a copper mine, which was heavily resisted locally. And she essentially said, you know, we have to develop.
Quentin, that there are many great unknowns here in for the coming weeks and months and years, but one of them surely will be the response of the president, Ten Sein, Than Shwe, the former prime minister, who is still seen by many in Burma as sort of the big military ruler, the sort of the power behind the throne, how they react to the NLD winning so many seats, particularly if Aung San Suu Kyi actually then wants to not just take power, but change policies.
She's been very careful already, I think, to say to her supporters, you know, don't gloat, don't rub people's noses in it. If she can find a way, if you like, to simply give a not discredited, but quiet retirement to some of these people, she may make it. But getting rid of people who've actually had, if you like, their snouts in the trough for a very long time is going to be difficult, because they've made a lot out of this. They've been totally in control. Giving up power is not going to be easy.
Isabel, what do you think Western nations can or should be thinking about how they can help to support Burma in the coming months and years?
Well, I think there are a number of ways. There is a lot of experience in Western nations, and Britain in particular, in bringing to the table entrenched enemies, if you like. So I can see that there might be some possibility in the not too distant future of playing a role somehow in helping some of those conflicts come to an end. And the other thing is simply investment. It's investment. It's, you know, helping draft laws that encourage investment. It's you know, as Quentin said, the economy was on the floor, and that included the infrastructure, banks, you know, bank accounts, all those essential things that you need to allow the country to move forward.
And also perhaps one more just for you, Isabel, how do you think China's going to respond to the possibility of Aung San Suu Kyi running Burma?
Well, they did invite Aung San Suu Kyi fairly recently to Beijing, and I think that they will issue a note of warm congratulation when this happens and trust that there are no more big demonstrations of monks on the streets calling for more democracy, because that doesn't go down well in China for obvious reasons.
It doesn't indeed. Let's move on. Now, back in 2001, Goldman Sachs economist Jim O'Neill defined a group of similarly economically upwardly mobile nations. I mentioned mobile and all the mobiles in the room goes off. With a catchy new moniker that banded together Brazil, Russia, India, China, and somewhat later South Africa. The BRICS were born, and ever since we've been hearing of other groups of nations who could be destined for economic well-being, ranging from the civets. Anyone with a guess on the civets? Colombia, Indonesia, Vietnam, Egypt, Turkey, and South Africa, of course. The pine economies. No takes on that. That's the Philippines, Indonesia, Nigeria, and Ethiopia. Anyway, last month, Goldman Sachs quietly shut its BRICS investment fund, having watched its assets drop by 88% from a 2010 peak. It seems that even the BRICS nations are now facing the reality that countries scattered both ideologically, easy for me to say, and geographically around the globe might not have as much in common as we thought. Quentin Peel, was the big problem with this is that nothing really linked these countries together at all, did they, in terms of their economies, aside from the fact that they were all emerging at around the same time?
Yeah, I hesitate to say it, but I think it was a pretty silly idea. It was a sort of, it was a brand,
don't hesitate,
it was a slogan, and they were always a mismatch. I mean, China is so much the biggest, Russia a country in retreat, India, yes, emerging, but a very different rate to China, and Brazil bumping along with its future eternally in front of it. So it was a bit of a nonsense. It did express the trend. Power is shifting from west to east. But apart from that, I think what the investors realised was it didn't make sense as a sort of investment platform. So they pulled out.
And indeed, I guess that's the issue, isn't it? When you look at it, them all together, you know, China might be a good investment at a certain time. Brazil might be a good investment at a certain time. India might be as well. But all at the same time, worth investing sort of, you know, concurrently, it just doesn't make sense, does it?
It didn't make sense. I mean, Jim O'Neill, in his defence, said that it was really meant to point out after 9/11 that globalisation had to, you know, take account of emerging economies, which was true. But then what happened, this was quite extraordinary the way people, and I guess it's a testament to the kind of magic power of Goldman Sachs, that people took this as a kind of tremendous theory that they had to hang everything onto, including the BRICS themselves, who set up a bank set up meetings and try to kind of, I mean, it's a bit, there's this town in Western China called Shangri-La, you know, and you think, well, that's not an indigenous name, is it? You know, and it's amazing how powerful Western ideas or things that look good can actually shape the behaviour of the people to whom they refer. As Quentin says, these economies had almost nothing in common. You know, Russia is a you know, one-stop shop for energy. South Africa, well, you know, we'll see. I mean, they are very, very different, and they're very different politically. So that even if you were to assume that they had possibly harmonious economic relations, which is not the case, the politics are still quite tricky, except if you tie them together in a general kind of anti-global rules as they are anti-Western thing. And that, again, wasn't ever really very convincing.
Well, it became, Quentin, in a way, a little bit like the non-aligned pact. It was a group of nations that were together for no other reason than that someone had put them together. And it was also, you know, cocking a bit of a snook at the West.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was rather fun to watch every time they got together, and they would go through such contortions to try and find a bit of common ground. And it really, the only thing that's ever come out of it is a development bank. Okay, but that's fundamentally a Chinese development bank. That's what people are interested in it for. And I don't think, even though, I mean, obviously there's a lot of talk when you look at Russia today, the Russia turning towards China and so on. That's always been a theory that I've been very suspicious of. And I don't think that it's a fundamental shift. So I think that this is probably best, you know, dead and buried now. Let's look. China is the important story. India is another one. But it's not the BRICS.
Isabel, you know, this was a symbolic story at the start. Is it a symbolic story at the end? Does it tell us something about the idea of, you know, the emerging markets over the last 10, 15 years, that actually that bubble has burst somewhat?
Well, it's certainly deflating slowly in several cases. I mean, Brazil is going back into recession. China is growing much more slowly than China says it's growing. Everyone, you know, it predicted it would grow more slowly, but it's not doing particularly well, and it's facing some pretty heavy weather for the next few years. Russia, we know about. So, yeah, that story is over. I think Jim O'Neill had tried to salvage his reputation, or at least get a new football onto the field when he made a series of BBC programmes about the mints. Which is,
I didn't mention the mints.
Oh, you did. You forgot about the mints.
Mexico,
the after dinner or whatever.
Indonesia,
exactly. And so these were essentially the emerging economies, yes, that hadn't been included in the BRICS. And you think, well, you know, again, nothing much to hold them together. And I think probably enough acronyms here.
Okay, there we are. We'll end the acronyms. Isabel Hilton, Quentin Peel, thank you both very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House. When we come back, we'll be slagging off the Brits.
Immerse yourself in the world of Monocle. Visit monocle.com. Listen live to our radio station, Monocle 24, or explore more than 5,000 hours of audio, every minute of every show we've broadcast since we launched. And don't forget that we have over 400 films to watch and share, while magazine subscribers can log in and browse our complete print archive on screen. Our online shop is here too, which you'll find well stocked with clothing, books, travel accessories, fragrances, homewares, and more. Check into monocle.com every day for fresh news and opinion from our editors and bureau around the globe. Then plan a trip to one of those spots for business or pleasure with our handy city and resort guides. It's all there for you at monocle.com. What are you waiting for?
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me in the studio, Isabel Hilton and Quentin Peel. Now, in recent years, the UK, once a leader in world affairs, has begun to look decidedly unsure of itself in matters of foreign policy. That indecisiveness ranges from how to deal with Syria to more everyday concerns when interacting with that eternal bugbear of the British politician, Europe. The much-touted potential Brexit of Britain from the Union hits headlines any time the nation has any kind of crisis of opinion on European-based issues. And now a critical new report from senior diplomats has suggested that Cameron and his cohorts need to decide the nation's direction once and for all. So is it time the UK decided what it really wants? Quentin Peel, this report is it doesn't say anything new, really, about Britain's sort of poor sort of diplomatic clout, but it does sort of bring everything together and make you think, ooh, this isn't good, is it?
It certainly says it quite forcefully, sidelined in Syria, ineffective in Ukraine, unwilling in Europe and inimical towards refugees. I'm very glad, actually, they brought in that line about the refugees as well, because it's all part of the same complex. But you do have this extraordinary situation at the moment. A German friend, quite leading politician, put it to me like this. At a time when Europe is facing a crisis with Russia, a crisis in the Middle East driving an enormous flood of refugees, and an economic crisis in the Eurozone, honestly, what on earth do the British think about geopolitics that they're trying to renegotiate a few little tweaks and turns on their EU membership?
Whether we actually want to be part of an ever closer union, or whether migrants coming here get 2 years or 4 years benefits before they, 4 years of work before they have benefits.
So tiny little details. And so it's as if we're losing sight of the big picture. And I think that has been a trend that's been going on for some time, although one cannot accuse Tony Blair of having been part of, he certainly wanted to play the big game on the world stage. Trouble was, he got it wrong. And as a result, it's not just the political leadership, if you like, but I think a wider feeling in the country ever since the Iraq fiasco, we don't want to do that sort of thing again. So that's compounded, if you like, I think, a period of real introspection and insularity in Britain.
Isabel, is it perhaps... I mean, should we actually sort of trace this back far, you know, to far, far further away? Because there was a period, yes, when Tony Blair was first in power, when Britain was taking a leading role in Europe, where, you know, he'd turn up to EU summits, and there was that famous shot of him on a bicycle. They were all sort of cycling away, and then he speeds off in front. It was this sort of sense of this new, young, dynamic leader who's leading in Europe as well.
I was just going to say, but
before that, it was, you know, Britain wasn't really much of a leader in Europe at all.
Well, you know, Thatcher used to handbag people, but actually the record is not an anti-European record. I mean, it was under Thatcher that we signed up to Maastricht, something that Tory backbenchers used to boast they'd slept through in the House of Commons. But, you know... I do remember when a new prime minister, it was absolutely routine that they would go and make a big speech in Bruges or wherever it was and declare that Britain was at the heart of Europe. That used to be an absolutely routine thing for them to say. And certainly I agree that the present malaise goes back to Tony Blair and the Iraq War, not because he showed ambition, but because he signed up to a particularly bad US administration, making a particularly bad series of judgments. Who knows why he did that?
And also within that, you know, it went against most of the opinion within Europe as well.
He did indeed. And you know, Britain has been, you know, somehow straddling this uncomfortable position between the US as its major ally, and that makes it somehow different, and it's a permanent five member and so on, and a future in Europe. My problem with the current set of arrangements is that Mr. Cameron doesn't seem to know what he wants, and every decision that the Conservative government seems to take seems to be a function of his inability to lead his own party. And, you know, these small decisions that Quentin complains about are really to please small constituencies within the Conservative Party. This is no way to run foreign policy.
Quentin, when William Hague became Foreign Secretary, the UK started to focus more on trade and started to look more at old Commonwealth countries. But at least there was a sense that William Hague understood foreign policy and believed in it and believed in diplomacy and relations. Maybe I'm being a bit too kind to him, judging through expression. But anyway, none of that can really be said for Philip Hammond.
No, I think it's definitely been a demotion of the job. William Hague did at least have substantial political presence, even though I would still regard him as essentially a little Englander. But I do think this has actually been quite a long period of inward looking. We're still back at that sense of Britain is still uncomfortable with its place in the world, doesn't know how to play it. The Europe thing has hugely complicated that, all the internal divisions. But nonetheless, you know, the fact that we're nowhere at the table with Russia on Ukraine and so on, left it entirely to Angela Merkel and François Hollande. And, well, it was very striking in Brussels. I mean, I remember the days when Margaret Thatcher was the Prime Minister and they had to basically build a special tent to fit all the journalists in who wanted to hear what she had to say. And now, who goes to hear David Cameron?
Is that also partly, Quentin, because Britain's not in the euro, and over the last 5 years, most of the EU summits have been concerned with the euro and its survival?
Well, it's not just that. I mean, look at the refugee crisis in Europe today. This is huge. And David Cameron is refusing to have any serious part of it at all. I was in Berlin last week and talking to Wolfgang Schäuble, the finance minister, and he said, look at the situation in Calais. 6,000 refugees. That's fewer than are coming to Germany every single day of the week. He said, it's a scandal and a shame that Britain and France can't deal with that.
I think we'll have to leave it on that point. Let's move on now to our final story of the day. Chinese President Xi Jinping and his Taiwanese counterpart Ma Ying-jeou met over the weekend. It was the first time the two leaders of each territory have been seen together since 1949. Isabel Hilton, how important was this?
Huge symbolic value. Actually, I think it's quite a long time before 1949 that the leaders of the Communist Party and the Kuomintang were actually seen together, since they were fighting a civil war for 5 years before that. You know, the first 30 years of Communist Party rule in China, Taiwan and the Kuomintang were the big enemy and not Japan. You know, that all changed in 1989. And the thing about these two parties is that they come from the same origin. And actually, they both believe there's only one China. They just disagree over who it belongs to and who should be running it. The Kuomintang's, you know, not doing too well on that front. But when the Kuomintang went off or was pushed off to Taiwan, they were definitely invaders. So, of course, on Taiwan itself, there is a whole other set of sentiments which had to be put down, first in a long dictatorship under the Kuomintang, and then has emerged since Taiwan became a democracy. And I think that if there was a concern in the mind of Xi Jinping, it was that the elections in Taiwan are about to return that party, the DPP, to power.
Quentin Peel, how important are Chinese and Taiwanese relations to the West these days? Because it doesn't seem as if it's as big an issue as, for example, as it might have been 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah, I think at the heart of the Cold War, it really was a point of tension. And it's less so. After all, Taiwan is a major investor in mainland China now, and that's been building up for a long time. Secondly, maybe the fact that the Hong Kong transition, although bumpy and full of protests in Hong Kong, nonetheless, it's fundamentally worked, may reassure people that the relationship can be solved. But having said all that, everybody's nervous, if you like, about the ring of security problems around China, South China Sea and Taiwan now. Nobody wants them to complicate each other and build up more problems. So I think that everybody's watching it pretty nervously. And the fact that you're, in spite of this meeting, almost certain to get a pro-independence party winning in the Taiwanese elections, means that that actually could get really quite tense.
Aside from the elections in January, Isabel, what do you think happens next after this meeting between Messrs. Xi and Ma? What's the big thing that you would be that worried about or looking at?
Well, I don't think that there was a huge amount of content to the meeting. I think it was an enormously
it was a picture
symbol. But you know, if you look at the issues behind it, in Taiwan, you may remember there was a little sunflower revolution this time last year, which was triggered by Hong Kong. So actually, what happened in Hong Kong and the shutting down of the democratic possibilities in Hong Kong told Taiwanese that whatever deal might be done in the future between Taiwan and the mainland, they'd better get, you know, they'd better get a triple underlined signature, because China has broken every such agreement. Another bit of British influence that was not exercised, by the way. They promised in Tibet on the 17-point agreement, and they promised in Hong Kong that there would be a certain set of political arrangements. And when it came to it, they said, no, sorry, that's off. Now, Taiwan was watching that very closely. So there would be Ma Ying-jeou can only go so far, and people will not let him go further.
I'm afraid we come to leave it there. Isabel Hilton and Quentin Peel, thank you both very much indeed. That's it for today's Midori House. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Jamie Waters and Clara Strunk. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. We're back at the same time tomorrow. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.